And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. And again, thank you to Bob Weichs, founder of Four Green Golf, and Tony Barrett, Click and Brick Confidential. Scott Sakoff will probably be back next month. But today we're really honored on the real estate panel to have an in-studio guest, a guy that's I think most people will recognize. And before I introduce him, let me disclose who we have in the on the panel today. Jan Long, welcome. You've been a regular when when Terry's not here.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm Terry Castrejure.
Yeah, that's right. Imitate Terry. Let me see how you can impersonate him.
I don't think I can do that.
He's just one in a kind, isn't he?
He is, and I have too much hair.
Well, that's right. See, there you go. Oh, he's calling in right now. Yeah. But Jan Long, of course, from Cast & Long Commercial Group. So welcome. You've been here many times talking about real estate.
Yeah, I've got my my BS down.
Yeah, well, that I thought you could say a BS degree in something. You're saying a BS degree in BS, right?
Yeah.
No, you're very good. How does Robert De Niro? You're very good, you.
Uh-huh.
I didn't sound like that, did I? Was that good?
You sounded like Terry Cass.
Yeah.
Wish I could have imitated
you. Oh, wait,
you.
Chris, you do that.
You.
Yeah, he knows what I'm talking about. And our newest panel member, this is a great honor, too, to have Christopher Gray, American Financial Lending. Chris, this is not your first show, but it's your first official show.
That's correct. I'm glad to be here. I like it. I enjoy it, and it's great to be with you guys.
This is excellent. And, of course, you are from, like I said, American Financial Lending. So we have a great panel today, and it is really an honor to introduce our in-studio guest, Don Goldwater. Welcome, Don.
I did not have relationships with that woman.
That was good. Talking about politics, you have been in politics, but you now are on stage live at the Improv.
I appreciate that very much. Thank you for having me here.
That was good. Do that again. I really like that.
Well, it's not really hard. All you have to do is stop drinking water and your throat dries up. You know, so you have to remember what it all depends on what the definition of is. It's sort of like our economy that's out there today.
That is hysterical. I love that. It was unplanned, by the way. But I love that improvisation is always good. So, Don, you're, of course, a real estate agent, REMAX Prosperity. I think what, in the beginning, I think what listeners may want to know is you got quite a name. Goldwater is well-recognized and well-respected, too.
Well, I'm trying not to screw it up. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. You know, Bob Sr. was my father, and he ran the stores and started the Phoenix Open. And then, of course, we had Barry Goldwater, who was United States Senator, who was, you know, I'm one of the lucky people in the world that I had three heroes in my life. One was my father, one was my uncle, and one was John Wayne, and I had an opportunity to meet all three of them.
Did you really? You met John Wayne?
Yeah, I got to know two of them. I won't tell you which two, though.
I want to know. So where did you meet John Wayne, by the way?
Actually, I was a young man, and I was about 9 years old, and Dad used to fly up to Sholo, and I was backing out of the plane and ran into a wall behind me, and I turned around, there was a belt buckle about eye length, and I've seen John Wayne movies all my life about 10 times. My kids just freak every time one comes on TV. And I started doing this little kid look up and looking up and looking up, and here's the Duke standing right in front of me. And Dad goes, oh, I want you to meet Duke. And I couldn't say anything. I'm like, you thought I'd met Elvis Presley. I mean, it was huge.
Now, can you impersonate John Wayne?
Well, I don't know, gentlemen. It's kind of hard for me to do the Duke.
Hey, that was good. Now, did you see True Grit when he won the Academy Award?
Oh, yes. Yes, as a matter of fact, I hate to see it because a lot of people have mentioned it to me, but the new True Grit that's come out is supposed to be a fantastic film, and I just can't drag myself out to see it. You know, it's sort of like blasphemy.
Well, I saw the new True Grit. I'm not sure. I think I like the old one, so I think you may not be missing anything, although it did get pretty good write-ups. How about you guys? Did you see it?
I've not seen it yet.
No?
Me either.
You're not
for the same
guy?
Reason, actually.
Is that right?
Yeah. I just can't bring myself to go.
You know, but talking about John Wayne, a friend of mine, Les Hunt, who was a politician from back in the day, he used to hang with John a little bit, and several of his older friends at that time hung with him all the time, and he was telling me a story about way back in the day when he was at a party with John Wayne and they ran out of things to drink.
Uh-oh.
And so they were on the highway going like crazy to beat the band when the police stopped them and asked for their license. And he kept looking at it and looking at it. And John Wayne said, well, are you going to write me a ticket so we can go or give it back?
I bet no ticket was given. That's my guess.
Yeah.
Well, he was a tough guy. But, I mean, maybe not in real life. But he, boy, what an actor, though.
A fantastic actor. And, you know, the story of his walk and stuff like that. When they picked him up, I forget which football team he was playing for. I think it was USC or UCLA when they found him. And they put him through the screens and stuff like that. And the director doing the screen goes, you've got to teach this man how to walk because he walks feminine.
Yeah.
And so his walk, he's actually walking pigeon-toed on purpose. You know, so if you really study the movies, you'll see that his toes are pointed, and that's where he got that famous
gait.
Yeah, because
that is so cool.
Can't have this manly man with a feminine walk.
Now, how about what's your favorite movie of all time with John Wayne?
That's a good hard one.
And he's made so many.
You know, True Grit, and I'm trying to think of the one where he played the P-40 pilot.
Jet pilot?
Yeah. No, not the jet pilot. This is P-40 pilot. The Flying Tigers, that was the name of the movie. I love that one. Some of his early cowboy movies when he wasn't really well known, it was in all in black and white. I know, kids, if you're listening to this, TV actually had black and white, and there was only three channels at the time.
Angel and the Bad Man.
Yes, yes. So there's a lot of movies that are out there I just love.
Yeah, he definitely is an icon, wouldn't you say that?
Definitely.
Yeah.
My 14-year-old son, I mean, a kid 14-year-old today, I mean, it's his hero.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. We have, like, every John Wayne movie.
Wow. That is so cool. So you should know these. What's your favorite movie, then? All right. Call your son. All right.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what we'll do. He's on line one. What is he doing on line one at school still?
Yeah.
No, they're out, actually.
Okay, that's good
Easter
to know.
Break.
Okay. Oh, that's right. It is Easter break. So, wow, I hear a phone. That's Everyone's looking for their phone. It's like one of those movies. They go, whose phone is it? And then the one that it is, they jump up in joy. They go, that was my phone.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord.
I don't know. I'm not going to say whose phone. I know it wasn't mine because I turned mine off. Anyway, let's talk a little bit, Don, about you've been around in politics all your life. How has that shaped and influenced you as a person?
Well, yeah, I think, number one, probably the biggest political lesson I have, and I try and pass it on, it was very interesting, and I actually got it from Barry and Hubert Humphrey. I walked into Barry's house, and I was a college Republican up at NAU. I was president of the College Republicans, and I was working on his campaign and Reagan's campaign. And I walked into Barry's house, and I looked over to the left, and Hubert Humphrey is sitting on his couch. And I looked over to my right, and Barry's coming out of the photography studio. And in so many words, I said to Barry, I said, what the heck is he doing here? And he said, he who? And I said, Hubert Humphrey. And he goes, what are you talking about? I said, he's the most liberal senator in the United States Senate. Why is he in your house? And he said, he's my friend. And I'm looking at him like, what? You're nuts? And he said, look, we don't agree on things. You know, but he's the most honest man that I've ever met in the Senate. And I can sit down and say to him what I believe, and he will give me solid, honest feedback. And if you're so afraid that you can't talk to the opposition, then it's time for you to recheck your thoughts, your thought process, and your belief system. And I looked at that, and I went, oh, you know, that makes sense. So it's enjoyable for me when I sit down and talk to somebody and they don't necessarily agree with what my philosophy is. If we can keep it on a civilized discussion and keep it on instead of the emotional aspect of it, but keep it to the facts, then what it does, it gives me a chance to go back and to recheck what I believe, to see if there's any flaws in my belief and stuff like that. So far, there hasn't been any. I'm just kidding.
But what a great lesson that your uncle gave to you.
Well, it was phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, and why can't people do that? So how has it changed? It doesn't seem like today's politicians seem to honor that.
Well, they don't, but they never have. I mean, if you look back at the beginning of this country, instead of calling people names and sending them threatening letters, we used to have duels.
That's right.
You know, they ended the duels. Now we got into the name-calling and stuff like that. So, you know, you have communists for the left side, and you have neo-Nazis for the right side, and it gets worse from there. And that doesn't accomplish anything.
Not at all.
At all. Because if you have an honest politician with a difference of opinion, and they really are trying to work for their state or their country and stuff like that, you might learn something. You might be able to see a different perspective from what they're saying and either craft your message a little bit differently or craft your bill or whatever it is that you're trying to do. You may bend it a little bit, not necessarily to accommodate them, but to help the people who believe their side of it understand your side of it better.
So that totally makes sense. So if you come from the belief that, number one, hopefully, you know, you got the, you're dealing with an honest politician, number one, and
which is rare.
Yeah, and that you assume that each side loves their country the mm-hmm. same, and you remain open, well, you might learn some stuff, right?
I think you do. I mean, you know, for example, and I get on the radio shows and TVs about this, we talk about the unemployment rate. Okay, so they quote you the U3 unemployment rate, which should tell you that there's more than one unemployment rate. Well, the U3 is employed and underemployed, and it's about 8.8% today. Well, if you think about this for a second, across the United States, 6% is full employment. So did 2.6% increase in unemployment cause all the destruction we've seen out there? So if you go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you'll see that it goes from U1 to U6. U6 is a broader range, includes people that comes off 25 weeks or have been out of work for over 2 years or that type of thing. Now you're starting to jump up. Well, I think it's 13 today, but a couple of months ago it was 18%. If you go to shadowstats.com, that takes all the changes that Johnson took out. If you have been unemployed for a year, you're not even alive. If your company has gone bankrupt, the people who work for you are not included in unemployment. Then that number jumps up to 22%. And why that's so important is that people are trying to invest their money or they want to buy into real estate, but they don't know what's happening with the economy. And they're not being given the correct rules. If they have the correct rules, they can invest and they can buy wisely. Sort of like if you went to Europe, to England, and nobody told you to drive on the left-hand side, you'd be driving on the right-hand side and you'd wonder why you got in a wreck. And so to the radio stations, I keep telling them, if you go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you'll see both those numbers there. They're, all the explanation is there as to what they are. I'll be more than happy to leave that stuff with you here. And you'll find out what's actually happening in the economy and not necessarily what the news media or the government's telling you.
You know, Jan, doesn't that make sense? I mean, fear can drive people, really modify people's behavior, shapes behavior.
Well, absolutely. And you see this out of the government all the time, or out of the media, both, I guess, when push comes to shove. And it kind of fuels some of the conspiracy theories and the sense that it's kind of a regime that's pushing the media to do its bidding. I mean, it's just there's so much obfuscation, I guess would be the word. They just muddy the waters so much, and they figure that that people just aren't smart enough to figure it out.
You know, in defense of the banking industry for a second, you know, everybody's mad at the banking industry because bankings aren't, you know, they're not lending, they're not doing this, they're not doing that. And since 2007, I think the banking industry owns 7% of the mortgages out there. 93% of the mortgages are actually owned by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Sallie Mae. And the banks are being handicapped in the sense that, you know, in some cases we know from some of our friends over at Thunderbird, the school out on the west side, the management school, we know that some of the bigger banks have been told not to loan because we have this new roll of ARMs coming due right now, and people are having to refinance, and you may have a $1 million home. Well, it only appraises at $500,000, and they go into refi, and the bank says, well, give me $500,000. Well, if I've got $500,000 free cash sitting around, I don't need to refinance. You know?
Absolutely.
You know, and that's part of the problem that's hurting with the short sales. I mean, do you see that at all?
Every day, all day long.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, I mean, I have clients that purchased homes for $2 million just within the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, rates were a little bit higher then. And they call up their bank and say, hey, you know, I put $500,000 down on the property. I was wondering, you know, how quickly you guys maybe could, you know, drop my rate a quarter or a half a percent, which is huge, of course,
sure.
on $1 million.
Oh.
And they're like, oh, no, you're value isn't where we want it to be to do that.
Right.
And you're sitting with $1 million equity or what into the property
right.
anyway, and you can't reduce your rate a half a percent.
Yeah, we did a little bit of a statistical analysis and found out that if you put down 50 to 60% on the property on average, then you're okay. You may be down 10%. You know, so you're doing all right at that aspect. You can stay with a house and stuff like that. But people, when you start talking about million-dollar houses, that's a completely different loan. It's not insured. They have to put down more money. But anything under $400,000, if people are putting down 10%, and that $400,000 home today is appraising in the high 100s, maybe low 200s, and they're trying to get out of a 7% mortgage and get down to 3% or something like that, they're SOL. That's one of the reasons why people are just walking from these things. Or in my case, we're trying to talk them into going to short sales or using the MARS program, trying to go back to the banks and saying, look, it's cheaper for you to reduce the principal and refinance than to sit with this house at a 60% loss for a year or two waiting for somebody to come in and buy the house again.
You know, are you seeing more luck with the short sales now than you were? I know a year and a half ago, it was a lot of headbanging to get nothing done. And
they put $250 million into the state, and one person qualified.
Yeah.
And so they're starting to wake up a little bit. Wells Fargo and Bank of America are redoing, I mean, literally on a daily basis, are redoing the MARS program. Wells Fargo is a little bit stronger, and I think the reason they can be is because they administrate loans. They don't have them. Bank of America owns the loans. So they're having a harder time having to try to write off their principal and stuff like that. But they're starting to catch up with the idea that this is a better thing to do to try and keep the people in the homes and then try and find a way to write the principal off. The big problem is here is when the banks – and correct me if I'm wrong, but this is the story I'm getting. The banks would love to take all these problem loans and write them off in a quarter and then be able to show three quarters of profit.
Right.
But the federal government is saying, no, you can't do that. And so if the banks write all these notes off over the year, the bank shows a loss and the federal government takes over the bank.
Right.
So
that's a real dilemma,
yep.
Chris.
You know, in that, in the short sale conversation, I think a lot of homeowners don't realize that for about the last, well, it's probably been about 2 years, but about really the last year and a half, if you've had a hardship and you can no longer afford your home, you'll most likely qualify for a short sale. And if you continue to make the payments on time, mm-hmm. and the reason I say that is because, I mean, when all this first started crashing, I mean, people were literally being told by the banks, well, we're not going to help you unless you stop making the payments.
Yeah.
You know, and so people would stop making the payments. Okay, that's what I'm supposed to do, and now you're just done. You can't borrow lunch money. But anyway, if you continue to pay your payments now and you are approved for a short sale because you've had a hardship, a true hardship.
True hardship.
You know, you can turn around and buy another home immediately.
And it's amazing on the hardship list. If you you can go to CDPE.com, which is works with short sales, and where I've got my classes through and was certified. But they have examples of what hardships are. Hardships could be like one of the gentlemen I'm working in with right now. He's a lawyer. Okay, now you would think lawyers are not going to have any problems, but his main source of income was working with people to buy and sell commercial property. Okay, so his income took
He's
a huge
work.
Hit. took a huge hit. Well, guess what? That qualifies because his loss of income, even though he's working, a sudden loss of income, illness. I mean, they have such a wide array of what qualifies for a hardship. That's the easy part of it.
So are you seeing like Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae doing short sales?
You know, I personally am not, but I have people in my office that do in the REMAX office over on 7th Avenue. It's Prosper REMAX, and you've got the card there. I just have my number, but it's the other number if you give that out sometime. They deal with Freddie and Fannie, and they are trying to work through short sales as best they can. I mean, Freddie's underwater. They're 10% loss, and they only have a 3% reserve. So it behooves them to take a lesson from the S&L crisis and get this stuff off their books.
Well, you would think so. Now, you just quoted 97% of the loans are Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac.
Mm-hmm.
And the short sales you're talking about are with, what, local banks and – main banks, because Fannie Mae, they have not been willing to work with anybody in the recent past.
Yeah, a lot of the banks like Wells Fargo will represent the Fannie Mae's and Freddie Mac's, and I'm not saying that as a certain, but I know that they service loans.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll see like Smart Street or Smart House, I think, signs out, and those are generally Ginnie Mae, Freddie Mac companies.
Right, HomePath.
HomePath, right.
You know, and those have special financing programs like, you know, investors for 15% down.
Right.
You know.
But isn't that kind of subsidized by the government, the HomePath thing? Isn't that that the whole idea of it?
Yeah, and that's
– I mean, that can't be a very large percentage of the
it's a small percentage.
No, and that's one of the problems is that when – if my brother works for Heritage Bank. Now, they called him back because he was retired because he went through the S&L crisis in banking. And when the issue first hit, he was in a board meeting, and they were all sitting around going, well, how do we handle this? And he goes, well, I remember back in the S&L crisis, this is what we did. And they said, you're coming back to work. And we've had things in a couple of our developments where we've actually had to fly people, the president, a national president of the bank, out from Chicago or New York because he was old enough to have gone through the S&L crisis, where some of the bank presidents here have not gone through the bank crisis of the S&L crisis, explain to them what our new business plan was, what we thought the industry was going to be, what we thought our sales were going to be, that type of thing, and how we intended in paying back the bank. And in a lot of cases for us, we accelerate payments back to the bank per lot. So if you get, I don't know, 10, 15% per lot, maybe we do 17% per lot, which the banks were looking at us like we were nuts, but we want to maintain a relationship with the bank, so you treat the bank well. Well, the national presidents looked at us and said, and looked at the presidents here, the guys running the banks here, and said, you guys need to be quiet. These guys know what they're talking about. You've never been through this. They understand it.
Well, the reason they haven't been through it, I don't know if you talked to a whole lot of bankers, but half the time they're in their 20s and 30s.
That's exactly right.
They don't have any.
Nobody,
At all, really.
Yeah, most of the people that, you know, if you think about it today, most of the people that are homeowners have never seen a decline in housing. I mean, that didn't happen. Houses were always going to appreciate. And that was the whole thing behind California. On the beach homes, they put like 5% down by these couple $1 million, I call them cracker boxes, and they'd hold on to them for a year because they'd know they'd go up 5 or 10%, and then they'd turn around and sell them, and that's the way it went.
That all spilled over to here too.
Yep.
Well, and as a lender, that's, you know, that was pretty much how everybody would relate to California. Is, you know, half their income came from their house.
Right, right. It was your biggest asset.
Right.
And now, you may not know this or remember this, but I'm sure you will. The term stagflation.
Oh God, yes.
Okay. Well, guess what? You know, now we're talking back into the nation years.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that's like 72. This guy's a real young guy.
I thought it was in your category. Don't even remember that.
Well, stagflation, it's real simple. You have assets going down, houses going down, but you have this huge inflation that's going up.
Yeah.
Okay, so you have stagflation. And I think it's funny that a couple things aren't included in inflation. Taxes are not included in inflation. So if the government increases taxes, that's not included in inflation. Food isn't included in inflation. Gasoline's not included in inflation.
So the most expensive things we have to deal with on a day-to-day basis aren't included in inflation.
No, and the way –
because they're too volatile.
The way they play with it is pretty funny, and I had to bring this along from Carl F. Peterson, the other company I work with as an investment advisor. They work with the GDP and inflation. They underreport inflation by 7%. And you can thank Alan Greenspan for that, because we won't talk about what presidents he was working for, but he was head of, you know, the Federal Reserve. He's supposed to keep the fox out of the hen house, and he made two changes that basically made us understate inflation. But they've got what they call geometric weighting, substitution, and hedonics. Now, geometric weighting, if you think about going into a grocery store and you fill up every month and you fill up your shopping cart with the same thing and you come to the register and you check the tape to see if it's changed or not. So they're going around and they look at geometric weighting, they fill everything up and they come back and they go, oh, you know, it's more. Let's see what we got in the basket. Well, you know, products, dairy products are more expensive and stuff like that, but we're going to give that a less weight. And, you know, the carrots over here are cheaper, so we're going to give that a greater weight. And so the tape evens out, all right? Substitution is they look down there and they're filling up the shopping cart and stuff like that, and they come up on those steaks, and they go, steaks have really gone up. Oh, my God, we're going to substitute. So they throw the steaks out, and they'll pick up ground round, or they'll pick up chicken or something like that so they can get to the checkout counter, and the tape's the same. The best one I love is hedonics, and we see this on almost every product today. And hedonics comes from hedonism. You went out and you bought a washing machine a year ago, brand-new washing machine, top of the line. And it costs you $1,000 for this washing machine. And for some reason, you have to go out today and buy another washing machine of the same kind. But this one costs $1,200. Well, that's 200% inflation. And the government goes, not so fast. The last washing machine you bought had a rotary dial, had three programs. This one's got a digital dial and has 12 programs. So we think that extra $200 is a wash. So we're not going to call that inflation.
So in other words, they can do whatever they want.
Yeah. So, I mean, for the average person, think of it this way. You went to the store about a year and a half ago. You went to Circle K about a year and a half ago, and you bought a Coca-Cola. A little bottle of Coca-Cola cost you 99 cents. Today it costs you $1.42. Is there inflation?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. It sounds like it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. This all goes back to the Fed again because they're printing more and more money. I forget what they're calling it now, quantitative easing,
yes,
which means printing more money.
Yeah,
wow, all these political correct terms, right?
Yeah, Quantum Leap. Isn't that a TV show?
I think it was.
Or quantum physics. Isn't that something, too? But when we come back from our break, we'll continue our discussion on the real estate panel. Of course, we have Jan Long, we have Christopher Gray, and special in-studio guest Don Goldwater. We'll be right back.
Weidenauer, Heinten & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues in corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Weidenauer, Heinten & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today. 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
What if your house is on fire, you call 911? The firemen don't know what to do, the truck's got a flat tire, the water hose has a leak, they can't decide what to wear, and everybody wants to drive the truck. This never happens because they have a process, they follow it, they're on the same page. I'll help you put your fires out with a business process. I'm Barbara Haggerty, helping you mind your own business. 602-750-4518. Increase the bottom line now. Even a two-person business needs a process, and I specialize in small business. 602-750-4518.
And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. This is the real estate panel, and pinch hitting for Terry Cass is Jan Long from Cast and Long Commercial.
Long Commercial Group.
Almost
Hello
gave
again.
You a promotion. Jan Long Commercial Group. That was good. Is Jim Casson listening?
I doubt it.
Oh, good, because then he would say...
He better not be. He's out there working on a deal for me. So.
Oh, good, good, good.
We can talk bad about him then.
Yeah, there we go. Let's do that. Let's have a gossip roundtable. And, of course, our newest panel member, Christopher Gray, American Financial Lending, and special in-studio guest Don Goldwater, RE/MAX Prosperity. Don, I wanted to ask you a couple things. You must have met along your journey here key politicians. You mentioned Herbert Humphrey. Who else have you met along your path?
Well, I used to play with Ronald Reagan's kids. As a matter of fact, Ronald Reagan Jr. wrecked my go-kart. Ronnie, if you're listening, you still owe me for that go-kart. No, I'm just kidding. So met them. I had my first introduction to politics really was in the Astor Hotel in New York. I was about 8 years old. Parents were back there for some reason, and Vice President Nixon got on the elevator with us, and I guess Dad and, and Nixon knew each other pretty well. I won't say if that was good or bad. We were going up the 15th floor. He got off the 8th floor, and right before he got off, something smelled awful bad, and he was laughing as he got off. So, I've been lucky and had a chance to be able to sit down and talk to some of the old politicians and some of the new politicians. John Kyle, we've had our differences over one or two things, but I'm really sorry to see him leaving. I think it's the absolute wrong time for him to be leaving at this point in time, assuming we get the Senate back. John McCain, used to be a solid, staunch reporter of John McCain until about 10 years ago, and I respect him and I respect the position, but I tell you what, he's changed in my opinion. He scared me the other day when he was talking about Libya, and now we want to put advisors in Libya to train them how to use our equipment, and that sounds an awful familiar. I think I went through the Vietnam era,
yeah,
and I think that's how Eisenhower started this mess. So, I've been real, real fortunate to meet a lot of people through my family and stuff like that.
No doubt. And what's some of the key lessons you learned? You talked about a few of them from your dad as well as from your uncle.
Well, my dad's key lesson was, look, son, you buttered your bread, now you got to lay in it. That took about 4 years of psychiatry to figure that one out. the basic thing was, shake hands. Shake it firm, look people in the eye, and don't lie. You're too stupid to remember what you said.
So that's a good lesson. And that was from your dad.
That was from my dad.
How about your uncle? I mean, of course.
Barry was he was kind of the adventuresome one. And so if you were not doing what he thought you would do, he would, in some manner or fashion, put the pressure on the backside and tell you to go out and do it. And basically what I learned from him was that there isn't very few many things that I think I can't do. I may not be successful at them, but it gave me the confidence and the guts to go out and try.
See, I think that's such a great lesson. Now, let me ask you this. I was always curious about this. If Barry was around today, mm-hmm. where would he fall in the political spectrum?
Well,
left, right, center, where would he go?
He's a constitutionalist, essentially. If you read Conscience of a Conservative, there's a quote in there that I basically live off of, and that is he was saying he would support no bill, no matter how good it was, without comparing it to the Constitution. And if it in any way was not in line with the Constitution, he wouldn't support the bill. And if his constituents came up and said that he was not following their wishes and their concerns, he would merely tell them that he thought their major concern was freedom, and in that he was doing the very best he could.
That's awesome. And, is he one of the few the last of the politicians that really spoke his mind, that really, like you said, he was good friends with Herbert Humphrey, and is he one of the few that would cross party lines and because it was the right thing to do?
Well, he crossed the biggest cross he did on party lines that I can remember was we had a congressional race, and we had Karen English, who was a Democrat, and we had Doug Weed, who was basically a carpetbagger in the state, and Barry couldn't stand Doug Weed because he was about four miles right of, I'm trying to think of the major religious person at that time. He just didn't like him. He thought he was a crook, and so he ended up endorsing Karen English because he felt he could get rid of her in 2 years, but couldn't get rid of Doug Weed in 2 years. I'm near young, and I'm hunting at the time. And at that point in time, the Republican Party used to call me when they wanted me to go up and yell Barry, which was real, real interesting. And so I've got like one of the first cell phones in the state because I'm kind of an idiot on technology. And I'm in Globe, and I get this phone call. And while I've got the phone call, I'm also listening to the radio that he's endorsed Karen English, and so I know where I'm going. And so I walked into his house, and he's sitting there. He's working on his radio. And I looked at him, and I said, heard about you on the radio. And he goes, what about? And I said, Karen English. And I said, I got a phone call from the Republican Party about Karen English. And I can't repeat on the radio what he said about the Republican Party, but I told him, I said, I'm proud of you, because I didn't like the guy either, and I understood the philosophy on it, and that's exactly what happened. Karen English was in there for 2 years, and she was gone after that.
So he was right.
Well, he was right.
A wise man, no doubt about it. Now, You told us a story off the air about you remember when Barry was running for mm-hmm. president, and you were about 9 years old, you said.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, election night was a nine-year-old election night. Your uncle's running for president of the United States. You don't know Adam from anything. So, of course, you know, my uncle's going to win. I mean, you know, my uncle's going to be the president of the United States. 7:30 rolls around. I'm sitting there with my dad on the couch, and he goes, okay, he lost. You can go to bed now.
How disappointed? Did you remember how disappointed they were?
I don't think Barry was too disappointed. As a matter of fact, the comment he made, because it was such a landslide. I mean, Johnson did a phenomenal job. But if you think about the commercial with the young girl picking the you know, on the atomic weapon going off in the background, his PR people were fantastic. And Barry was not going to. I mean, people told Barry, "You've got to do this, this, and this." And Barry said, "Hell no, I'm going to do this, this, and this." And so he knew he wasn't going to win the minute that John Kennedy was shot.
Really? Why is that?
Well, he just knew John. He just knew Lyndon Johnson, and he knew Lyndon would do anything he needed to do in order to become president. Mm. Kennedy and Goldwater were going to get on a train, I'm trying to think. You had Roosevelt, and then you had his vice president. Brain dead. It's quick, somebody tell me who was president when we dropped the atomic bomb.
Oh, Truman.
Truman. They were going to do a Truman and jump on a train, and they were going to go, you know, city to city, and then they were going to debate off the back of the train, and that's how they were going to run their campaign. And then the minute Kennedy was shot and Johnson walked in, they knew that, you know, all bets were off at that point in time.
What was their relationship like with John Kennedy and your Uncle Barry?
I think it was pretty good because Barry used to goon him a lot. Kennedy had a rocking chair in the Oval Office because he had a really bad back from the PT-109 crash and stuff like that. And Barry made it a point to go when he went into the White House, he'd go sit in the rocking chair, and Kennedy be like, "Barry, get out of my chair."
Did they respect each other?
I think they did very much so because, you know, it was, you know, Kennedy had been in the Senate, and I think he had high regards for him. He didn't necessarily agree with his politics. And, you know, I find it funny because back in 64, Kennedy was a liberal. And now the Republican Party holds him up as a conservative. Now, how far left has the Republican Party gone?
That's sort of interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is amazing. Wow. So what are your political aspirations? I know you ran for governor, what, in 2006, I believe?
Correct.
What do you still have a passion for that?
I always have a passion for helping people in the state. Right now I'm chairman of the Pachyderm Coalition, which is a statewide organization. It's a Reagan Republican organization, and we work with local and state candidates, count all the way down to school boards, and we raise funds for them, stuff like that, with the Political Action Committee. So I still travel around the state on that. I've been asked to run on a couple of races, and my answer always is if the state of Arizona, whatever the state of Arizona needs me to do, I will be there. So if the state needs me to shut up and go away, I have no problem with that. But if, you know, they need me to be a dog catcher or county board supervisor or run for governor or what, and I think I can honestly be a benefit, then, you know, I'll take a hard look at it. There's not an ego situation here. It's not like my identity is wrapped up in politics.
So where does Arizona need help that they can use Don Goldwater?
Well, Arizona needs help in teaching its elected officials that it's not their money. You know, right now, going back to the Nixon years, we had the misery index and stuff like that. So now we have Arizona, and Arizona's number one on the misery index. You have the cost of living index, where California is at 132.7, which means the average is 100. It means that they're 32.7% more expensive to live in California than it is on average across the United States. Well, companies are leaving California. Why aren't they coming to Arizona? Well, because Arizona is at 103.6, which doesn't sound bad, but Texas is below 100 at 91, Oklahoma is at 88, Missouri's below that. And so if I'm a businessman, you know, sure, I love Arizona, and it looks great, and it's got the best scenery and skiing and golf courses and everything else, but I'm looking at the bottom line because my investors are looking at the bottom line. And if I can pay somebody $50,000 to do the same job in Texas that I would have to pay them $57,000 to do here in Arizona, I'm moving my company to Texas. So like we were talking beforehand, we have legislators that say Amazon's not paying their fair share in taxes because people are buying books online, so we want to raise taxes on the Internet. And I look at them and say, well, now you're expanding the taxes to services. Why don't you not do that and just lower the taxes that people who are bricks and mortars have to pay so that they can do better for their people that are investing in them and they can make a better livelihood? People will want to come in. You have cities and towns like Prescott, for example. Their main industry is getting people in. It's construction, is tourism and stuff like that. And if they can't get people in, they can't build homes. They can't build homes. They're not raising any money. They go broke.
So who's really responsible, you think? I mean, is
we
it a whole collective effort from both parties? They're not really cooperating to do the, you know, strategically put the right programs in place and the path to get businesses here?
No, I think what it is, and I'd love to write a book about this, and the name of the book is It's My Fault.
Nice.
Okay, because we have got the government that we deserve. You know, Reagan had a philosophy of 100% philosophy. 10% was getting people elected, and 90% was standing behind them and making sure they kept their word on why you voted for them. And if they didn't keep their word, get them out. And so when we're out talking and we're talking about real estate or we're talking about investment, it just amazes me. People ask the same question that you did, and in a sense, and that is, how do we get government to, and you stop? And just stop right there. This is a republic. Representative republic, where the power is the people, and the power comes from the people to the leaders, not from the leaders to the people. So it's up to us, you and me, to stay active within the political system, regardless if you're an independent, conservative, liberal, whatever it is, constitutionalist, to make sure that these people stand upright and stand faithful to their cause and to be active in it. And if you're not going to do that, then this is the type of government you're going to get.
Why does it, as a working class person, why is it that everybody I talk to feels like it's not you and me, or it's not the government and I, it's the government saying, here's what it is, and then push through, and then we're raising taxes over here, and it's pushed through, and we're drilling, we're buying oil from over there, and it's pushed through, and the working class gets further and further down on the totem pole. I mean, the working class is no longer the middleman, it's
because we've been led to believe that. We've elected people out there that told you that your voice doesn't count, you know. And I think where that started change was on the 2007 immigration bill. You mentioned mine running for governor. One of the stances I took was I was very strong on illegal immigration. I didn't want it. It wasn't fair to the illegals. It wasn't fair to the business. It wasn't fair to the people. And, you know, I was chastised pretty heavily for that. And nowadays what I have said is actually weak and more commonplace than ever. But they were going to pass that bill through Congress, and Bush knew he was just going to run it over and there was going to be no problem. And the people reacted, and they flooded people's phones. We shut down the White House. When I say we, I don't mean just you and me. I mean the country shut the White House switchboard down. John McCain's office had to find another phone number because nobody could get through to them. And the bill died. And this was a guaranteed bill. You know, so this is what's happening. The Tea Parties have come out of this. You know, people are just absolutely fed up because people are starting to go back and reread the Constitution, you know. And that's the key. We have just been asleep at the switch. I don't know if it was Reagan. You know, everything was great under Reagan, so to speak. Some people don't think so, but we had a good economy, and Bush took it over after that, Bush Sr., and it stayed pretty good through there. And then we got Clinton in, and Clinton didn't mess it up too much, but then we got Bush Jr. back in there, and the people I blame for this economy the most actually are the Republicans, because we had a Republican representative, we had a House, we had the Senate, and we had the presidency, and we outspent the Democrats, and we put more rules and regulations, and we killed business, and people went, this is not what I voted for, this is not the Republican Party, I'm not supporting the Republican Party. Obama comes in with hope and change. And everybody said, I hope so. And so he came in, and we got hope and change, and now hopefully we get it out. We got the House back, and in this next 2 years, hopefully we get the Senate back. But there better be a warning out there for the Republicans, and that is, well, two questions. I have to ask you guys this because I ask everybody this question. What's it take to become a Republican?
Jan.
You guys are doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Everybody looks
very
like,
little.
Yeah. What it takes to become
a patriot?
Well, no. All it takes to become a Republican is a check on the box. Okay? Oh. I mean, literally.
Right.
You know, I could be from Florida and I could be the most liberal person and you don't know me and I come into the state and I register Republican. Then the next question is, what's it take to be a conservative?
Wait, let's go back to Florida. I don't know if they can do the check in the box.
No, I'm saying if I move in from, yeah, they got
are there Chads
they got
involved?
The Chad in the box. Yeah.
And then we'll be counting it for a couple of years. I don't know.
But, you know, so I come back in and I say I'm a conservative. Well, the only thing it takes to be a conservative in this state is to say, well, I'm a conservative. And then people will find out if you're a conservative after you're in office. Well, that's part of the things that, you know, the Tea Parties and the Pachyderms and the 2012s and other groups like that, we vet candidates in the primary. We go find out their history. We had one gentleman, Tony Bowie, came in from Florida and said exactly that. I've been a lifelong Republican. I'm conservative as heck. We checked up on him. He was a lifelong Democrat. He was not conservative. We had some of our elected officials in federal offices that were backing this gentleman. And, you know, we're going up to them going, what have you been smoking? You know, I mean, did you check this guy out? And they're like, no, we didn't.
Kind of like a birth certificate.
Right, birth certificate. So, you know.
Certificate of live birth.
You know, this, you could take away the federal government and the states still exist. But if you take away the states, there's no federal government. Okay, and so, you know, you're in commercial construction and you're in banking and I'm in investments and in real estate and running for my life trying to pay my bills. If I don't pay attention to it, and we all don't pay attention to it, then we're going to put more rules and regulations on each one of our things and not even recognize it. I mean, the Obama medical care bill, 3.8% sales tax on home sales to pay for that bill, okay? And that wasn't even written in the bill when they voted the bill in. They wrote it when they came back after Christmas, and nobody knew about it until the Association of Realtors, National Association of Realtors, started digging into this mess and going, we got a problem here. This is going to kill our industry. And the banks went, yeah, us too.
Oh, right, yeah, right. I'm talking about writing off your interest on your home was
right.
Shoved in the bill at the last moment.
Right,
okay.
So, you know.
Yeah, that would have been done.
Wouldn't it be nice to be able to provide medical, top-rate medical. Wouldn't it be nice to provide top-rate medical to everybody who needs it?
Yeah.
Okay, that would be great.
Right.
Wouldn't it be nice
That's
if we
nice
could
thought.
Afford it?
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
You know, right now, the interest on the national debt matches our GDP.
Wow.
You have to think about that. This is the worst time we've ever been in. They talk about, you know, we're out of this recession, and yet, you know, I'm looking at shadowstats.com, and I'm looking at Bureau of Labor Statistics, and I'm looking at, National Bureau of Economic Research says we're out of this recession, and all three of these other government agencies says, no, we're not. Home sales are down. You know, your rents are up.
Rents are up a little bit, yeah. Occupancy's up a little bit.
I got to believe it.
But you've got a lot of foreclosures coming up that have just been put off, and they aren't going to be put off anymore. So we're getting to a point where we're going to be flooded with foreclosures.
So it'll be an all-time record, in your opinion, for coming up?
Yeah.
Coming up.
So what will that do to the economy? Is it we're going to go double dip, maybe?
They've been talking double dip for a long time on this issue. And if you weren't going to a double dip, why are they talking to Q3? Why are they talking about doing another stimulus package?
Right.
Another one. Tell us about that.
I'm just hearing bits and pieces about it. You know, I heard it on the radio the other day, and I mean, we've called it
Pandora's Box.
Yeah, Pandora's Box. You know, the other Q2 and Q1, and correct me if I'm wrong on this stuff because I could be blowing smoke in the air, but it's from talking to people. Most of the money went back to the federal government so they could buy back treasuries and keep the interest rates low. A lot of the money went to the banks so the banks could invest in the stock market and keep the stock market going good. I'm not saying your bank, but
right.
Some of the major banks, stuff like that. And so, you know, you'll see things like the stock market goes up 325 points and everybody's like, oh, you know, we're out of the recession. How broad is that? Is that you know, it's the Dow Jones Industries. Okay, it went up 325 bucks, but there are thousands of stocks on the New York Stock Exchange. Does that mean that they all went up?
No.
And, you know, that type of situation, or they'll come in and they'll say, well, unemployment rate's down.
Well, does that mean that we created more jobs, or does that mean that people have lost their unemployment benefits and are not filing?
Right. And I'm not a pro in any of the politics or economics or any of that, but just talking to neighbors and things, when they said that, it's like, yeah, people's unemployment ran out.
Right,
yeah,
right.
I mean, that wasn't hard to figure out. Sure, it went down.
And if you look at the length and depth of this, and I tried to find the chart for it today, and I'm sorry, I'll send it to you. I couldn't quite find it. But the length and the depth of this recession outweighs the recession in 1934. So guess what? I'm sorry. You know, recession's when it happens to you, depression when it happens to me. But I always thought it was two quarters.
That's what it's supposed to be.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get real. If you tell the American people the truth, they'll react accordingly. And if they get government out of the way and let the small entrepreneur get back to work, we'll come out of this thing.
People are trying to come out. And it's just like Don just said. If you tell the people the truth, if we know where we're at, here's the playing field.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can come out. You know, we always do. Stop changing the rules. Stop beating around the bush.
What's your recipe for getting the government out of the way?
Us. You know, we have to phone call. We have to email. We have to vote. I mean, it's ridiculous when you go into a primary and you have a 28% return on that. There's a lot of voter fraud out there. I was talking with one of the people working with the county elections department. And they came up with an address that had 26 people registered to vote at the same address. It's a vacant lot. I called Helen Purcell up before the last election. I said, is it a little strange that I'm getting mail for 10 people at my house that don't live here? Mm. You know, so there's a lot of work we've got to do on voter fraud. But more importantly, your one vote does count. You know, you may not think it does, but if one and one and one and one vote, then it gets out there. And I used to tell people, I said, we don't have the luxury of getting off of staying on the couch and not voting. You got to get off the couch and vote. Well, nowadays, we don't have the luxury of just doing that. We got to go next door and start pulling people out of their houses and saying, look, this is your country. You've got to participate. You've got to vote.
Right. You know, it's just so sad. I mean, people seem to be so discouraged that they become apathetic. Mm-hmm. And you got the extreme left and the extreme right seem to be passionate, and they're sort of really controlling both parties in a way, because the passion's coming from both those sides, and the people in the middle, they're just sitting around, like you said, they're not really doing anything. So how do you really motivate the middle? I mean, how do you get them out to really recognize it is their country, and you better get on the ball, because that, like you said, that's the only way that we can really send a message to the politicians.
Well, I think this time around, I think you have people like Nancy Pelosi and Mitchell and Obama and stuff like that are probably one of the greatest motivators for conservatives to get out and vote, because it's hitting their wallet. And when it hits your wallet, then you react. I remember Skip Remsen, when he was mayor of Phoenix, and Skip and I go back, we don't necessarily agree with everything, but we go back a long ways. And the last time he ran, he's one of the best campaigners I've seen locally. And last time he ran, he wasn't campaigning at all. And I looked at him, I said, Skip, you're going to lose. And he said, no, I'm not going to lose. And I said, how could you possibly say that? He said, Don, it's a good economy. They don't vote out incumbents in a good economy. Well, guess what? People are out of work. People are starving to death. People are worried about if their car breaks down, where are they going to get the money to pay for that or the electrical bill? You know, what happens if somebody, you know, gets hurt and they can't pay the medical bill? What's the issue on the border issue with all these drugs coming across and illegal aliens coming across, you know, government taking over insurance? People are scared and they're upset, and they're going to get out and vote because they need to get a change.
You know, that totally makes sense. And, we're at the end of the program already. Can you believe that? So, Don Goldwater, thank you so much. If people want to get in touch with you, how do they do it?
You can call me, 602-317-6506. The website we use politically is pachydermcoalition.com. It's pachydermcoalition.com. Check out the website. Give me a call. If I can help you in real estate and if I can learn more about banking, and good luck to the guys in commercial.
And we need you to run, so next time let's hope you're running for something so you can help Arizona.
Well, I appreciate that. Right now I think I'm running for my wife in the frying pan, but you know.
Well, thank you so much. Chris, how do they get in touch with you?
I would say just call me on my cell at 602-332-3414. And then from there, I can give you websites and things like that.
And John Long.
Right. You can reach me at 602-432-9882 or on the internet, jan@klcomgroup.com.
Excellent. Well, again, Don Goldwater, thank you so much for being here.
Well, it's been a real pleasure being here, and, you know, I'll bring Monica along next time.
Absolutely. I want to meet her anyway. And we're going to have our debut of our Wednesday edition, Sports and Entertainment, George Hamilton in studio tomorrow, as well as Eric Mehta, NFL agent, going to comment from New York on the NFL draft and all the other stuff that's going on. See you tomorrow.